Welcome to the Fred and Faith Debate on Frederick's News Radio 930 WFMD, brought to us by Putman Plumbing and Heating. How can we make you smile? I'm Troy Skinner. I want to invite you to go online to WFMD.com, keyword faith. It'll take you to the Faith Debate blog or webpage or whatever you want to call it. There's all sorts of information on there, some of it good, some of it probably not so good. Part of what you'll find there are links to all sorts of religious worldviews. I spent some time trying to find websites that I thought were representative of the different views. So if you're looking to find out, what do Buddhists believe? You can find at least one link to that's pretty representative of what Buddhists believe by going to the Faith Debate page, for example. There's lots of different pages that have to do with Christianity because we're so fractured as a Christian people. So there's lots of pages there. On the show this week, we're going to talk about some of the things that will fracture the Christian church. We have Jonathan Schweitzer, senior pastor at Crossroads Valley Chapel and co-founder of the Frederick Faith Debate, and Jace Broadhurst, senior pastor at Poolsville Baptist Church in Poolsville. And this is the same panel now 4 weeks in a row. The first 2 weeks we talked about biblical text and how do you know what to take literally? How do you know what's merely metaphor or, you know, merely some sort of poetic construct that, you know, it says that God's this and God's that. Well, does that mean he is that? Well, maybe not. I mean, it's supposed to tell us something about God and how to understand him. We talked about that a little bit the first couple of weeks. Last week we took a detour with this panel and talked about Well, we took a time out and went through Faith Debate Seminary 101.
Yes.
And we talked about what is systematic theology, what is biblical or redemptive historical theology. And it sounds really boring, but I thought it was really fascinating and interesting. And I thought, kudos to both of you guys. I think Jonathan and Jace did a really good job on talking about, you know, seminary kinds of stuff in a way that the average bloke could understand, because I understood you, and I'm a little couple notches below the average bloke, so I could stay with you. But I want to get back into what do we take as literal, what don't we? And I thought we might naturally go here within the first couple of weeks, and we didn't. So now I'm going to force the game a little bit. Pop culture would take us here, and I think we would be negligent not to go where pop culture would take us.
Right, because we always follow pop culture.
Absolutely,
don't we?
Yes. We want. You know what? We joke, but seriously,
we do.
and I think for good reason. At least I could keep telling myself this.
Uh-oh.
We want to be relevant.
Yeah.
Right? And one way to be relevant, I mean, Paul shows us the way in the New Testament by meeting people where they are. You know, for the Greeks, become a Greek. So pop culture, and maybe I'm loosely defining pop culture, but it seems to me that pop culture is enamored with the apocalypse and the end of the world and Armageddon and what's going to happen and who is the beast and who is the Antichrist and, you know, what's going to happen. And then, you know, Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins have made quite a fortune for themselves. They're the co-authors of a series of books called the Left Behind series of books. And I read them all. Did you read them, Jace?
No.
Did you read them, Jonathan?
I read some of them.
All right, that's fair. I read pieces of them.
I mean, they're bordering on pop tripe, if you know what that means. I mean, they're pulp fiction kind of stuff.
I liked them precisely because they engage the imagination about passages of scripture that are difficult to understand, and approaching it that way, I think is helpful to get us out of saying, okay, well, it's absolutely going to happen this way, or some theological treatise that says that it has to be bam, bam, bam. And I like the idea of engaging our imagination when we come to the apocalypse and trying to grapple with what is it actually trying to say.
Oh,
and so I kind of tended to take it that way.
I agree. Using the imagination is incredibly important. I think this is a great tool that LaHaye just jumped right on and used.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, same way with using music. Use it because it filters into our mind and get a fantastic idea. I just wish his theology was worthwhile when he did it.
Right.
Oh, sorry. So, did I say that out loud?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
You say that, and a lot of people are going to say, what?
What? Left behind should be left behind?
What are you saying?
Yes.
And we've talked in general terms about this, but I think that the history on this is, you know, Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins are dispensational in their view. If you were listening last week, you heard a little bit about dispensationalism. But dispensationalists, when they're reading Revelation, they're going to say that, you know, it talks about some locust with a head that looks like a lion or whatever and wings like a whatever, and that's really the way it's going to be. So I'm just going to randomly see if I can pick something here as representative. I don't know if I should have been prepared for this. All right, this is from Revelation 19. a rider on a white horse. Then I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, the one sitting on it called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he judges and makes war. His eyes are like a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems. And he has a name written that no one knows but himself. Now, I'm going to stop right there, because as I understand the Left Behind series approach to this, might not be true of dispensationalism as a whole. I'll grant that. I think it probably is, but I can't speak authoritatively to that. But just that couple of verses, the Left Behind series approach would say that, okay, heaven opened and behold a white horse means that there was a white horse.
Do they actually believe that?
But they would say that his eyes...
I didn't take it that way.
But they would say that his eyes are like a flame of fire, meaning that, oh, well, like means like a flame. But if it had said his eyes were flames of fire, literally... Now, if you read... I read the whole series, and they have this rabbi, Ben Judah, the Jewish guy who converts to Christianity. He's a character in the novel, series of novels. And Rabbi Ben Judah teaches on how to understand passages like this, and that's the distinction he makes in the novel, that when it says like, it means like. When it doesn't say like, it's the real deal.
Literal.
So it's literal. Mm. So Jesus, because that's who they're talking about in that passage, faithful and true, it's Jesus coming back. Jesus will literally ride a white horse from heaven down to earth, would be the view that they take in that. Now, I don't hold to that view. I'm not sure, based on the reaction I'm getting from you two, that you will hold to that view. But why, if you're going to take that view, if you're going to disagree with Tim LaHaye, who's, I think, does he have a doctorate? I think he has a doctorate, doesn't he?
I don't know.
He's seminary trained. I think he went to Dallas Theological Seminary, and you know, that
was a Southern Baptist pastor right here in Maryland for a little while.
Was he? I didn't even know that. And he's very well regarded and well known, and he's sold millions and millions of books, so he must know what he's talking about, right?
Right.
So why wouldn't we say that Jesus will literally come down on a white horse? And I don't want to make this about Tim LaHaye, but that passage in Revelation 19 says he comes down on a white horse. Does he come down on a white horse?
A good Old Testament version of that would be that on that day that the Lord is going to set his feet on, Zechariah 12, is it? That he's going to set his feet on the Mount of Olives, and they'll split. One half will go to the north, the other half will go to the south. It's a similar idea that is in the Old Testament. I personally don't feel like it's all that important to me whether or not he's going to show up on a white horse or not. I feel like what's important to me is that he is going to destroy evil, and that he's going to expose evil and bring it to justice, and that we can trust that that's going to be the case, and that evil itself will grow to the place where it actually is like a beast, that it's alive and it's ridden by the whore Babylon, that it's this immoral amalgamation of people that have rejected the purposes of God. And that the point is the bigger idea that a lot of people are going to reject God, and they're going to form a system that is going to have to be destroyed if true justice and true righteousness is going to be established on the earth. And that Christ is going to come and he's going to do that. And when he comes and does that, it will be like a war. It'll be a war on the heavenlies. Our battle is not against flesh and blood, principalities and powers, and that those principalities and powers will be destroyed. And so, like, when I read seals and trumpets and bowls of wrath, I see different parts of the war, and I guess I'm saying that I don't read it as literally probably as some do.
Now, I'm not going to disagree with you because, you know, I don't take it literally. But why should we be comfortable with that? For example, in Isaiah, and the exact passage is eluding me at the moment, but you'll probably know this, Jace.
Yeah, right, because I know every passage of the Old Testament.
You know every passage by heart. So... and all the various nuanced versions of those passages, right?
Right.
But Jesus rides in on a donkey in the New Testament.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, a direct connect to something in Isaiah that's
56.
Is it 56?
Yeah.
It talks about, the servant of the Lord or whatever, he's going to ride on a donkey. Literally, he rode on a donkey.
Now, in order to fulfill the prophecy.
Now, if that didn't happen,
yes,
we could say, well, you know, it because the donkey represents, if I understand, I'm going to be really hazy on this, but that donkey represents some sort of a sacrificial animal, and so it is representative of the sacrifice. So there's a symbolic thing going on there in the passage, but then there's a literal fulfillment of that. So when it says in Isaiah he's going to ride on a donkey, and he literally does, it wasn't merely symbolic. So he who is faithful and true rides on the white horse is symbolic, but is it also literal? Like, should we expect Jesus on a white horse? And if we're going to say, well, we're not sure that we want to say that, you know, why should we be comfortable saying that that's not going to be literally true?
Yeah,
nobody wants to answer
air.
That one. It says there's going to be bowls and cups, and like you said, Jonathan, and we say, well, I don't know if it's important. Why? Why should we? I'm kind of playing devil's advocate a little bit because I don't subscribe to this. But, I mean, on the face of it, it seems like it makes sense.
Well, let's start with the seals. The major important thing to me about the seals is that the Pandora's box that is our sin, that is the sinfulness of the entire world, at some point is going to have to be opened up. And somebody's going to have to open that thing up and fix everything. And who is it that is worthy, that is up to the task? I'm not, you're not, I don't know anybody that is. And so who is it that's going to have the authority to open up those seals? And when he opens them up, there's a whole slew of things that are represented by these horses and by the earthquake, the black sun, red moon, you know, falling stars, these kinds of things, that when it happens is representative of the Pandora's box has been opened and it's ugly. You know, and then when we come to the trumpets to me represent warfare. You know, everywhere in the, you know, many places in the Old Testament, trumpet is warfare. Well, that's the spiritual battle. You have a third of the sun and the moon go dark. You know, a third goes into blood, a third of the earth, trees and grass. Well, a third of the angels fell. It seems to me like it's referring to some kind of a spiritual battle between, you know, Christ and the angels. And then the bowls of wrath are just God's final wrath. It's when God says, okay, now I'm done with everything. And it seems to me like what he's describing to us is what's going to go on in the heavens and the ultimate judgment of Satan and the angels and all those that chose to follow him. You know, I feel like that's sufficient. Does it have to be actually, you know, that we see a white horse go out or a red horse go out or a black horse? That's not, I don't feel like that's so important.
Why would it be important that Jesus literally fulfilled a particular part of Isaiah then with the donkey? What would be the reason that he would have done that? Going out of his way to do that. He sends people to go get it for him because, you know, and it was waiting there for him and he knew it was going to be waiting there for him. Why was that important?
I don't know that passage in Isaiah, I'm wanting to go look at it here, is a passage that is apocalyptic, you know, that needs to be read in an apocalyptic way. Certainly Daniel's passages talking about beasts is very apocalyptic, but the Isaiah passage is talking about the coming kingdom. I don't know that it's abundantly clear. I mean, the point is that Christ wanted to make a point, that Isaiah seemed to be catching a hold of a point, that the servant, the Messiah, was going to come humble and lowly. And that's a pretty significant thing. And how better for Christ to say, yes, that is the case, than to actually ride in on a donkey? I mean, it's a very concrete thing. Look, I'm humble. I'm lowly. I'm not coming in as a riding, conquering hero. And that's precisely why he was, you know, rejected by so many of the Jews, because he didn't come as a conquering hero to set up peace on the earth, but he came first as the sacrifice, as the one that was bruised for our transgressions. And so it seems to me that that part, the metaphor is that he's the lamb. Was he actually a lamb? No, but he's the lamb that was slain, you know. And so for him to come in riding on a donkey, I don't know. I guess I feel like that. It's concrete enough a way to express that he's coming in lowly, that it doesn't ring of apocalyptic literature.
Now, the reason I'm asking the question is, you know, the normal person picks up a Bible and are trying to understand, okay, what am I going to try to take literally? What am I not? How do they come to grips with that? Now, and you struck on something that occurs to me, and
yeah,
Jace is going to be able to speak to this a lot better than I ever could, but in Isaiah, he's maybe using kind of a poetic
style there and metaphor and that sort of thing. And then to make the point that Jesus is the Messiah, is that suffering servant, he picks a few points in the Old Testament that he's going to fulfill in a very specific
way. Very literal way, yeah.
Very literal way to make the point that he is who he claimed to be and who others later would claim that he was. And that's not what's going on in Revelation, because Jesus had already come and the proof was already in the pudding kind of thing. He died and rose again or whatever. But and then the other thing is genre. In Revelation, it's apocalyptic language, mm-hmm. which is by definition, right, is going to be bigger than life, hyper-exaggerated metaphor, right? These really bizarre kind of... Isn't that kind of what the language is?
Well, yeah. The problem with apocalyptic literature is there's not a lot. I mean, there's not a lot of canonical apocalyptic literature, and we gave it that term based from Revelation. So it's kind of a circular... You know, we call it Revelation literature. It's the apocalyptic literature.
Yeah.
So we're... And then we see other things that correspond to it. So a little bit of trouble defining what apocalyptic literature is. There's been some pretty good work out there, but... Yes, normally we see it as talking about lots of angelic things going on, lots of number symbols, those kinds of things. And it seems very symbolic. There's just a lot of symbolism there that's not in, for instance, the Gospels, or at least not to the same degree. Now, how do you determine what symbols are literal and aren't? I mean, for me, it would seem very strange that Jesus would... ride a donkey in. It's like, okay, well, I'm going to make sure that I fulfill this particular prophecy literally. Is he going to fulfill them literally at the end of Revelation? Well, I mean, see, I don't have like an end of Revelation kind of idea, so we might differ on that. We were having this dispensational question.
Yeah,
I don't
yeah,
see.
I'm about
I don't
to
see
get dispensation out.
I don't see the bowls and the trumpets.
I feel it coming.
All that in the same sense that you do, as if there's some kind of distinction between these. I see there being very repetitive.
My point is that they're repetitive, you know, in a way that's describing different parts of this big thing that God's doing. You know, like to me, it's clear that he deals with the sun, you know, and he deals with the sun in the first seal, first trumpet, first, you know, and and then he deals with it again on the fourth,
right?
You know,
not
and,
a second time,
yeah, yeah. Well, but it seems to almost follow the 7 days of creation. I actually did an Excel spreadsheet and put all the sevens next to each other and try to summarize them, because I see all these similarities that again give me the impression that we're not thinking seven actual seals, but we're talking about a thing that he's dealing with, you know, that he wants us to understand. So, anyways, I don't. You know, but coming back to the question of the donkey, it seems to me that the majority of Old Testament prophecy is concrete. Like this is part of the reason that I'm of the opinion that there is going to be a final salvation of all Jews. You know, that there is still a role for the Jewish nation, because their prophecy tended to be very concrete. And so, you know, when he says in Zechariah, it wasn't Isaiah, it's Zechariah, where he says, here he comes lowly and riding on a donkey. He's saying, rejoice greatly, daughter of Zion, daughter of Jerusalem. And then he says, I'll take away the chariots from Ephraim, the war horses from Jerusalem, and the battle bow will be broken. Well, I mean, there's no reason for me to think that that's not going to happen. If he's going to take the chariots from Ephraim representing the northern 10 tribes, the point is that Ephraim's not going to be a military powerhouse anymore. He's going to take away all their military strength. That's like a very literal, concrete, no more chariots, you know. And then the same way, he's going to take away the war horses from Jerusalem. Judah is not going to be set for war anymore. It's not going to have that strength. It's a very concrete, specific, and then he'll proclaim peace to the nations. His rule will extend from sea to sea, from the river to the ends of the earth. Well, that's obviously fulfilled in Christ. It's not completely fulfilled, and this is the reason why many Jews have a hard time thinking that Jesus is actually the Messiah. On this show, Rabbi Cosman said, well, when Jesus sets up peace on earth, I'll know he's the Messiah. Well, you and I know that that's going to happen, and I've talked to a bunch of Jewish people, rabbis through the years, that have said the same thing. You know, when Jesus sets up peace on earth, then I'll know that he's the Messiah. Well, we Christians know that peace is coming first and foremost in a spiritual sense, but we all anticipate the day when it's going to also be in a very real physical sense, in a concrete way. And so he's a stumbling block to the Jews. And am I saying that right? foolishness to the Gentiles. Yeah. He's a stumbling block because he ended up doing things in a spiritual way when they were expecting total concrete way. Because their literature, I think their prophetic literature leans in that direction. Whereas the apocalypse just doesn't give me the impression that it's attempting to be, though all the other prophecies, like this is the reason why the Olivet Discourse, to me, clearly meant up until AD 70. The Olivet Discourse, you know, that all this stuff is going to happen. It lines up very, very closely with historical events that happened in that time frame. And so to me, it was a clear prophecy about specific things that were going to happen, and they happened. And he said, watch out that no one deceives you. There's going to be false messiahs. False messiahs came. Wars and rumors of wars. There are wars and rumors of wars. Signs in the heavens. There were signs in the heavens. Bam, bam, bam. All those things happen. You know, but the one place that he refers to something apocalyptic is where he says, then you will see the Christ coming on the clouds of heaven. Well, that refers back to Daniel. It's the only place in Scripture where it talks about the Messiah coming on the clouds of heaven. And that's a clear apocalyptic description. Well, we didn't actually see him coming on the clouds of heaven, but he did ascend on the clouds of heaven to the Ancient of Days, just like Daniel said that he would. And so my point is that Christ's prophecy in the New Testament was very clear, was very concrete. The prophecies in Revelation, to me, are just like Daniel. They're apocalyptic. There's beasts, and the beasts are going to be torn down, and they're going to come out of the sea, and there's this great thing. And so, to me, you've got to interpret them, you know, in a totally different way. I don't know if that makes me – what does that make me, dispensational?
I don't know what that makes you.
Strange.
I mean, I like the worldview. I wish in my mind it was so simple that things were so concrete about the Old Testament, but or even about Jesus' prophecies. I think the issue – I wonder how we can possibly do that. I think the issue is just so much bigger. I mean, what is prophecy? What is the genre of prophecy? What is writing prophecy? What is actual spoken prophecy? And how do they correspond to each other? Does the New Testament authors, do they come back and do they look at the Old Testament prophecies and do they make their conversations fit those Old Testament prophecies? Are they allowed to do that? We say, yes, of course they're allowed to do that. Are we allowed to do the same thing? I mean, the question – I just see nothing concrete that's part of – I mean, even the prophecies we know of, you know, Isaiah 7, you know, virgin. I mean, that's the only reason that I know that was fulfilled is because, you know, Matthew decides to talk about it, you know, as if it was fulfilled, because it certainly doesn't look that way to me, what happens in Jesus' time. And in fact, most of the prophecies that are said to be fulfillments of the prophecy don't always look very much like the prophecies. You know, Rahab crying for her children. That doesn't look anything like what I thought they were talking about, if I were to read that back.
Yeah, the point is that it fulfills the meaning Rahab, that section of the country where Rahab died, you know, is mourning over her children. So Rahab is mourning over her children.
Now, the one thing, we only have, you know, very short time left, but I do want, if you can, in 45 seconds, when you talk about, I wish it was so concrete, and there's this and that, all these different aspects. I mean, it seems like that's playing into the postmodern mindset of, you know, nothing really means anything. It's all subjective, and it's going to mean one thing to Jonathan, something else to me, something else to you. There is no concrete. There's no way to really know. But that is that what you're saying, or that's not what you're saying? And if not, why not?
Like, well, I don't think I was going quite that far in saying there's no way to really know. I'm just saying that I don't know. So I'm not a skeptic. I don't believe that, you know, I'm certainly not agnostic. Well, I'm not an agnostic in the fact that I just don't know. I think there's one thing I learned from doing PhD studies is the stuff that I knew when I was teaching Bible studies in church, I was wrong about, or I just didn't know enough about, because I had a certain amount of information and it all made sense to me. And then when I learned more, all of a sudden all the things that were very easy to understand were no longer easy. And so I don't have quick answers for things anymore, which makes me a terrible radio person, because I used to have all the answers and people loved it because I was, you know, I could just do things quickly and I could answer it and here's what it is and I'm pounding the pulpit and we're done. And now I have to stop and think a whole lot more about all the other things that interconnect, how Babylonian literature comes in and how other apocalyptic literature comes in to the book of Revelation. They're just, too much information, it seems like. But
sure.
It seems to me that that's a good place to be, and it's going to have to be a good place to end. Yeah. I want to add one thing. I think that a difference between a postmodern, and what I mean by postmodern is what I said, where, you know, everything's subjective. You can't really know what's truth. There is no truth.
Yeah.
What's true for you might not be true for me, and we can both be right, even though, you know, we might both be wrong or whatever. But that's not what Jace is saying. Jace is saying he might not know, and he's wrestling, and he's studying, and he's praying, and he's working through the text, and he's trying to understand. He's asking tough questions, but he's not saying it's unknowable.
Correct.
It is knowable, and he's pursuing to know what is the truth, which is different from the more postmodern view, which is you can't know the truth, so why even kid yourself? So anyway, we're going to wrap up there. Jonathan Schweitzer, Senior Pastor of Crossroads Valley Chapel, and Jace Broadhurst, Senior Pastor of Poolsville Baptist Church. I'm Troy Skinner. Our sponsor is Putman Plumbing and Heating. How can we make you smile? Thanks for listening to the Frederick Faith Debate on Frederick's News Radio 930 WFMD.